This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by listeners like you. Thanks for being patrons at patreon.com/thetomeshow. Welcome to The Tome, a D&D news, reviews, and interviews show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner.
And I'm Tracy Hurley, and in this episode, number 367, we're going to draw a card to determine our destiny as we discuss the Book of Many Things, Part 4? Been at it for a while, huh?
It's been a minute, but if things go well today, we'll be halfway through the book. We continue to have a great pair of panelists with us. From our normal panel tonight, we have drawn both the Sun and the Moon cards because everyone knows that Brandis Stoddard and Jared Drasher are the sun and moon that guides this podcast series to being as good as it is.
Jared is indeed very bright, and I am but a humble reflection of his majesty.
Oh, geez.
That means you're the moon, right?
That's what I'm saying, yeah. I am accepting my title as a loony here.
But am I correct in remembering that the moon card grants a wish?
Might be a thing.
You might be the most desirable card in the whole deck, Brandis.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, I don't give you 50,000 experience points or a castle, so I could.
I could wish for a castle.
I mean, maybe it's got cash limits. That's how wishes work now.
No, not in my world.
Every djinn has an abacus.
If you want to house rule me to be more powerful, Jeff, I will become more powerful than you can possibly imagine.
Excellent. Go for it.
All right. So as you all know, we're here talking about the Book of Many Things. As you may or may not know, this book is a bit of a collection of a bunch of different things. There are a broad range of things that we decided would be a good opportunity to take a new format for the show. Rather than one episode to look at a new product, in which I'm desperately trying to quickly read and get done before the episode starts, we're recording the episodes a little more often, but we're doing a deeper dive into a handful of chapters for each episode. And let us know if you like the format. For this episode, we'll start with Chapter 9 and hopefully get to Chapter 11, but not go bankrupt. And to start it off, it's disclosure time. Brandis, Jeff, and I are working from review copies. Jared is not.
Jared is the one honest broker on the panel.
That's right. But so, you know, I'm open. I'm open. Stuff. I don't want to sound like I'm not open to things.
Put him in, coach. Put him in.
Jared is our only honest broker, but he's open to bribes. He doesn't need to be an honest broker.
I'm but a poor corrupt public servant.
Absolutely. So if we get through Chapter 11 tonight, which the more we chit-chat, the less likely that becomes, that means that we will have done 8 episodes to finish this whole book, because there's 22 chapters.
I do want to say that we're headed toward the adventure chapters that one talks about quite differently.
That's true.
So I have some hope
that those chapters will go faster, or that we'll spend a whole episode on one adventure.
That we can spare more of our episode for just this nonsense. This is what I show up for, guys.
Okay. Right on. Personally, I don't hate this format. It's certainly easier for me to keep up with the reading, even when things get busy. Although, as the pacing of releases increases more than it has been of late, that could become a problem. But we have, 2 to 3 months, I guess, to talk about this book while we wait for new things to come out. So it works out. So
I don't know.
Go ahead.
I was just going to do one thought. I don't know if I'd want to do this for a whole big adventure book necessarily.
I agree with that.
But this book in particular is great for it. Sorry.
I was just saying it sounds like too many spoilers. Yeah.
Yeah. And we could do something like this for like a Fizbin style book or the Big B's book, when we're delving more into like, here's a handful of here's a thematically a themed book, you know, that talks about one thing, but it's not an adventure. It's not telling necessarily a story. I can see that. But in any case, let's talk about this book. We left off having just talked about chapter 8, so we are ready to talk about chapter 9, which is Night. In the Deck of Many Things, the Night card is one that you draw, and it summons an NPC knight to come and work for you. And so this chapter talks about how to do that. Integrating some of the ideas from earlier in the book about how maybe the cards aren't magically altering reality, but they are predicting the future. And so there's a narrative to it. So, you know, it doesn't magically summon a knight. What does it look like if instead it is predicting that you will run into a knight who will work with you or enter servitude or whatever? And then it also deals with, this chapter also deals with some magic items specifically for martial sort of characters, kind of, and our Heroes of Destiny section that we got like almost entirely through the last episode before I suddenly realized, oh, this is just a thing. They're just doing a whole bunch of these for different types of classes. And then I totally picked them up and I used them in my own game like last week.
Very nice.
Yeah. I also discovered that, if we're going to skip around a little bit, I discovered that not every character fits what the card pulls for their table, but a lot of the tables give things give sort of background things that are general enough you could kind of make them work regardless for other classes. And so, you know, somebody pulled a card, I looked at the chart for what their class was, and I'm like, that question doesn't, or that little background tidbit doesn't seem to actually connect to this character at all. I'm just going to, you know, not even tell anybody and look over at this other chart, you know, look at the sage chart instead of the knight chart or whatever and do that. And cause that one fit better and it was more interesting. So,
I mean, with that kind of chart, if the results on the table doesn't fit what you're looking for, lie.
Well, just lie. Right. Except that the results on the table match the card to some degree.
Sure.
And I wanted to maintain that continuity between what was on the card.
No. I'm agreeing with what you did. That's
yeah. So
that got me thinking though, it would be interesting to like have all of the archetypes for which there is a table and ask somebody like, which archetypes do you think fit your character? Because for example, if you're a paladin, you may not just feel that you are on the knight table, that you are also on the previous one that we looked at that is for the priest characters. So that might be interesting to get an idea of like what multiple things can you see yourself in, like a duality or something like right. that.
And that was a little bit of what was going on, is that I was it was a ranger character and I figured that probably fit best for the knight table, and then whatever they pulled is like, this doesn't fit this character at all, and I popped over and used the sage, which I think is for the spellcasters, and that actually in hindsight ended up being the right call, because when they leveled up after finishing chapter one of the wild Beyond the Witchlight, they leveled up to level two, and that player decided, you know, I think I'd like to respec this character as a druid instead. It's like, oh, sweet, because that's the background element that we pulled early. It was the cards predicted it. The card said she really needs to be a magic user. So that's the middle section, Heroes of Destiny. We've talked about these at some length, and we just talked about it some more. Like the others, it is a... you know, you pull one of the 22 cards from the original deck, and there is a little background tidbit for your character that they call the heroic tie. And the way I did it is I always start my sessions with an opening question. It's really early in the campaign, so people are still developing sort of who their characters are and what their backstory is. And so I had them all pull a card and then look to the appropriate chart and said, okay, this is a true thing that happened to your character in the last 8 years. tell us about it, right? And that was our opening question for this section, and it worked pretty well. Should we go back to the first section of this chapter then and talk about the magic items?
Yes.
Definitely at some point, yeah.
Let's do that now. Tell me about the magic items.
So there's a lot of different things, like some weapons and some armor, and I think this one has some ammunition, but I could be wrong. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. One of the things, I don't know, it felt different to me than some of the other magic items, but it could also just be that I'm a different person today than when I read the other chapters. But if, like, we have one, is this the one where we have one of the cursed items? Or is that there is one item, the Shield of the Tortoise, that actually has a curse on it. Spoilers. which I don't remember seeing in the other ones. And then things like the Spore armor, and I'm trying to remember the name, so sorry for the scrolling of my mouse. It was like any creature, it's centered on you, and any creature has to make a saving throw, and I couldn't tell if that included yourself, the armor of fungal spores. So it just felt like there's a little bit more options here, and a lot of them seem to be allowing you to cast spells without being a spellcaster.
It maybe it's because of the way I'm spending my free time these days, but it reminded me a little bit of the design approach seems to remind me a little bit of the way they designed for Baldur's Gate 3, in that there's a lot of armor or weapons or whatever, and the effect to make it more interesting than just like, here's another plus one sword or whatever, is that they have different spell-like abilities. And there's a lot of that going on in this section too. So go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, the armor options have, you know, definitely bulked out since 2014, but comparatively, I think stayed light for a good while. Mm-hmm. And then there's a magic whip is just wild. that's just not even a thing. So I'm delighted with that. And like the fact that it's about moving creatures or objects 5 feet closer to you is sort of nice and all, but like if you're not using something called a grasping whip for your traversal challenges and you don't hear some very specific theme music in your head when that happens, then I don't know you.
I was more drawn to the Captain America shield, which is definitely a thing, right? The boomerang shield where you can throw it and it does some damage and bounces back to you.
I have a deep cut that is getting deeper all the time because I don't think Disney's revisiting it anytime soon. But the dried leeches reminded me of like Yuuzhan Vong weapons from the New Jedi Order era. Throw a leech at someone, it attaches to them, keeps them from casting spells, and then starts eating them.
I mean, that is amazing.
Mm-hmm. And then that hammer of runic focus seems like it's a very good like visual in a game with no visuals, but yeah.
Yeah, it's a very good visual, but sort of it's a +3 hammer with it sort of roots you to the spot,
right?
Like it's sort of awfully good to be quite so bad.
The other one that I wanted to bring up though is one that has a name of something that has been in multiple other editions, and I like this version much better, and that is the Sword of the Plains. Because if you remember in other editions, the Sword of the Plains was just a way to unscrew yourself because traveling through planes screwed up your magic items and made your pluses go down. And the only thing that the Sword of the Plains did was it didn't increase its pluses same way. This one is actually cool because you can cut the air open and walk through it to other places, which is what I would want something called the Sword of the Plains to do.
That does objectively rule. So yes,
there is a sword in DC Comics that does that, but it goes to one specific plane. But I always found that to be pretty evocative.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also pleased with the bow of melodies that is the bard the yeah. bard weapon that always existed in my head, but I don't know that I ever saw statted this well.
There was definitely one of these at least in third ed, and
oh sure,
if there wasn't one in fourth, I'll eat my hat.
I mean, what is it? Is it in like the old Disney cartoon Robin Hood where somebody uses mm-hmm. a harp to fire an arrow, right? And basically from that moment, it was like, of course, this needs to be a thing for bards.
Yes, that's definitely how these items work. You could absolutely. Mm-hmm. I know I am very good at harp.
All right. Any other magic items that we want to talk about? There's a whole mix of things. There's
a ton of stuff, and I'm delighted with them. I am really surprised to see sort of how there's some, hey, this thing's yet to be extra good because it doesn't work all the time, like the Blood Rage Great Axe. Mm. It cares about you being bloodied, and it doesn't do its cool thing of being +2 to attack and damage, except for while you're bloodied, mm-hmm. but it's an uncommon weapon, so that's it's really there to be very early for you to have a +2 weapon, but it's only +2 some of the time.
Yeah, no, that's another one that made me think of Baldur's Gate 3, because I have at least 2 magic items in that game that work very similarly. Like if you're below 50% health, you get a +2 to attacks, funny. Or you can disengage for free, or it's, you know, stuff like that. So yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
One of the things I wasn't sure about, and it's probably because I usually don't read into this level of detail, for the ammunition stuff, like it's like the leech in particular I'm thinking of, it becomes no longer magical. Does that mean you only get one of them or a small number of them and you have to keep track?
It's definitely, you get a small number of them and have to keep track, I would think. Or, I mean, you could have just one that gets handed out. That's an option. There isn't an obvious default here.
Yeah, it felt a little different. I don't know how to put it.
I don't think it's assuming that you're running around with like a pouch of 20 of these.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Right. It felt weird because I know they're trying to provide a range of stuff, but mm-hmm. it was like you're dealing with things like Tidecaller Trident, and then you have this dried leech that works once and then goes away forever, becomes non-magical.
Every potion and scroll in the world is sort of, yeah, I'm a consumable, what?
Right. Yeah, usually you don't mix the consumables in the long-lived stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, they haven't released that much magical ammunition.
What's interesting with the dried leech is that, am I incorrect in assuming that this is a throne item? Like, it's called ammunition. It doesn't explicitly...
It says any ammunition, though.
Yeah. I mean, you could implicitly have a dried leech arrow.
Okay. That's weird.
It's not the very clearest thing, but
yeah.
that is what I take from what it says.
Mm-hmm. I could see it as a sling bolt pretty easily, but when you get to a crossbow bolt or an arrow, that feels weird to me.
I would picture that as actually looking like this weird dried long worm that is in a arrow shape instead of it being attached to an arrow.
Yep. Okay, I can see it now. You fixed it. All right. So we talked about the magic items. We talked about the Heroes of Destiny.
Actually, there's one more magic item that needs to get called out. I'm so sorry. The Wraps of Unarmed Prowess. Mm-hmm. Because it's monk itemization, we haven't seen itemization for unarmed strikes like this in a while. There's some good stuff in the tattoos and Tasha's, but other than that, I think there was something in Horde of the Dragon Queen, and that's about it.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Really good itemization for unarmed strikes has not been a thing for the most part.
Weird because I remember this kind of thing in third, and it made me think, wait, surely we had this before now in fifth. No, I'm just thinking back to third.
Mm-hmm. Nope, you're just thinking of what every reasonable GM would eventually create.
Right.
Because, like, there's nothing surprising about what's actually written here, and that's fine. Not everything has to be surprising.
Right.
It's just work.
Well, it's not surprising, but it's filling a hole.
Yes.
That seemed obvious.
Yes.
All right. So let's talk about what happens when we draw the knight card. And they talk, most of this section is about sort of different ways you can approach meeting the knight and doing it that way instead of just magically summoning the knight. And they talk about, you know, here's all these different types of allies the knight could be. Are they there because they're grateful to you, or because you share a common enemy, or they're studious and you happen to be exploring the thing that they want to study, and so they've come in and pledged their loyalty to you for that.
It's interesting to me because in these descriptions, it kind of shifts the knight from what you kind of think of from the regular magic item description, where this is someone that attacks for you or maybe is a bodyguard, to being more of these could be support characters mm-hmm. that do things that your party isn't great at.
Mm-hmm. Which is arguably something that DMs could and maybe did for years anyway. They didn't just have a nameless, mm-hmm. faceless knight show up, but created a subordinate or whatever that became a whole character of their own.
I am sort of amused by keep allies less powerful. in my Tuesday night game that I'll be playing in about an hour from this exact moment, the GMs have leaned really hard into giving us allies that come with us and join in combat. Mm-hmm. One of whom we as the players named Let Me Solo Her, which is an Elden Ring joke, but it explains how mind-bogglingly overpowered the NPC was, and we just didn't care. It was fine. Like, we just cheered her on. Right. She was living her best life, murdering everything. Mm-hmm. Good old Let Me Solo Her. She had a name, but we didn't learn it.
Yeah, no, and that's in the section about sort of giving advice on how to handle these sort of NPC companions. And that is part of the advice. It's like, yes, that should generally be a thing. And I'm trying to think of, like, I ran Descent into Avernus twice. Lulu is an NPC that is with you for most of that campaign. And I handled it two different ways with my two different campaigns. With running it for my children, I actually followed this advice and I kept Lulu less powerful because we had just gotten the sidekick classes. And so Lulu was like an expert because I kind of figured out that's what they needed in the party, is they needed somebody to be that sort of skill person. And then oddly enough, with my adult group, when I ran it, I just gave Lulu full on classes. And so was arguably just as powerful as they were, except that, of course, I only took support and healing spells. She was a sure. cleric bard. Right. And so she had basically zero damage dealing potential, other than her trumpet blasts from her trunk. That's the word I was looking for. and so she was mechanically not less powerful than them, but she was not, the point was, she's not going to be a spotlight stealer. And I think that's the point of the keep allies less powerful, is that they're not mm-hmm. stealing the spotlight. Not that they're less powerful isn't really the goal. Not spotlight stealing is the goal.
Yeah, the thing I've been doing with my Saturday group that I'm running for my daughter and her friends is they have a couple NPCs with them. And at initiative count zero, I have the NPCs use cantrips. That's it. That's what they do.
Nice.
Yep.
Not a full-on DMPC.
No, I mean, I figure if I want to kill one, I'll kill him.
Right. And that's the trick, is that you don't want a full-on DMPC because that always reeks of, like, you're dipping your toes into two different pools, and that shouldn't be the case, right?
Right. And in my Tuesday Night game, a lot of the sense of it is just, it's okay if the fight is over a little bit faster, whatever. It doesn't matter.
And I believe in this section, they do also mention that one of the things that you can do to keep someone from overshadowing your PCs is letting the PCs run some of the NPCs mm-hmm. that are traveling with them, mm-hmm. which I have definitely done that before too.
Yep. And they also give the advice of doing like I did with my first Lulu, of look at the party, figure out where the gaps are, and then make the character who's going to fill in the gaps rather than do the same thing as one of the party members.
It's hard to go wrong with there's some extra healing. Like,
right.
That takes relatively little away from even fairly healing-focused PCs.
Yep, absolutely. The last part of this section is interesting to me because it gives a stat block for a creature called a Deck Defender. And I think that I say that this is interesting because most of the chapter kind of works from the assumption, or at least the opening of the section works from the assumption that you are narratively running into an existing knight who's going to join you. Whereas the Deck Defender leans real hard into the, no, you pulled a card and it summoned this knight construct character who's going to come with you and work for you, made out of folded up playing cards. It's an interesting step. So that's an interesting shift, right? Yeah. And the other part that is interesting to me is that they built this stat block to grow. So its attacks are based on its proficiency bonus, and its proficiency bonus is based on your proficiency bonus. Like its hit points are a certain number times whatever level you are. It's what, five plus five times your level is the number of hit points that the Deck Defender has. So it grows, it kind of levels up as you do, but never leveling up to the point that it's ever going to overshadow you.
Yeah, it's built like some of the newer companion creature type things that some of the subclasses have had.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Whoever is in charge of the thing kind of determines its stats. So in other words, it's not just like a CR5 creature. It is these are its base stats, and then these stats are all based on whoever it works for.
Right. The procedurally generated stat blocks.
Right. But it's interesting.
I really like those as a general thing.
The Deck Defender stat block kind of leans heavily in the opposite direction of the entire rest of the chapter, right? Because it's not taking this character and making them an NPC, and it's not running into an existing personality character who's going to join you, right? It's you pull a card, this construct appears. It doesn't really, like, it's not an NPC. It's not going to talk to you. It can't speak, you know? So it's not going to talk to you. It's not going to have a lot of say in what happens. But it's there to sort of do your bidding as a construct to fill in that role.
Yeah. So the chapter has like three different fully contrasting ideas, basically. Yeah. Right. Sorry, Tracy.
Oh, no. I was also interested in it. And again, maybe other things had this, but one, the idea that if it goes to zero hit points, there is no way that you can bring it back. So it can create interesting dynamics in the party or the game. And then the other one was that protection mode, because technically it's any creature. If the Deck Defender can see it attacks, if it attacks another target within 5 feet of the Deck Defender, it can impose disadvantage on the attack roll. And it's interesting because that could include your own party members if it decides to, as the reaction.
Mm-hmm. It could, right? Hard to see why it would, because it doesn't have a ton of will of its own.
I could see there being like an inter-party conflict and the mm-hmm. character who controls the Deck Defender doesn't want you to hit the NPC or whatever. Like, I could see it playing out that way, but that tracks.
I mean,
yeah.
Slow motion. No.
My other thing about it is just loving the sort of mirror mask aesthetic of the art on page 72 for the deck defenders. That's really cool to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. And it does have three different modes, which is interesting as well.
Yep. Guardian, Acrobat, and Berserker. And you like decide what to be after every long rest. You can refold the deck defender into whichever shape you want. Berserker, Acrobat, and Guardian. And each one of them has their own special ability. The Berserker gets to do a reckless strike as part of an action. The Acrobat form gets to do a swift step as a bonus action. And the Guardian gets to do that protection thing that Tracy was mentioning as a reaction.
And it's also interesting to me, just after having read so many things where it's like next dawn, to then be like after a long rest.
Right. All right. Well, we have already been talking for like half of our time and gotten through one chapter. So let's see if we can talk about the sun in 15 minutes and the moon in 15 minutes to keep it to.
Here comes the sun.
Right. So the sun in the, in chapter 10, sun, they introduced to us an organization, the Solar Bastion organization, and it only has the one section. It's just one section of let us tell you everything that we can about this organization called the Solar Bastion. They're yep. almost a goodly knightly order that keeps track of decks of many things out there in the world and make sure that they're not going to cause too much trouble. Does a lot of research into it, tracks the sort of creatures that are associated with the deck that could be problematic. Make sure that people aren't going to get in over their head or use the decks for horrible, evil things.
Yep. They also warn you about the bad guy faction. That is sort of their opposite numbers.
Mm. We'll show up in a later chapter.
Right. Yep. Is that the Grim Hollow or Caro?
I think it's interesting that this is another one of these things that we've been getting in fifth lately, which is a multiplanar faction.
Yep.
And it's funny because these multiplanar factions that we've been getting in fifth feel, at least to me, more multiplanar than the Planescape factions do.
Oh, that's fair. Well, and this multiplanar faction isn't just multiplanar. They have, because part of this section is like the map of their headquarters and the description of its locations and what have you. And one of the locations that's clearly pointed out is the Spelljammer Harbor. So they're out there taking in Spelljammers. So it is both. This location is the intersection of Planescape and Spelljammer.
It's an orbiting city that is in the prime material plane, a different part of the prime material plane than you're probably playing in, but it is firmly set up as a Spelljammer location.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the deal with Grim Harrow : undead?
So it's not Grim Harrow : undead. It's just that is the normal grammatical use of a colon to shift ideas. Undead is the start of a new idea in that sentence.
Undead that pursue. Okay. Because it was very unclear, because I thought they did it more than once.
It does read a little weird.
I think one of my favorite things in here is just the idea that the Solar Bastion might come to your players and have them counsel someone in how to use a deck of many things. But you will be sending your PCs to someone else to give them good advice.
Right. Which is not usually what PCs do or follow good advice. Now, I am integrating, after having started reading this book, I am integrating the Deck of Many Things into my Witchlight campaign, right? And I've talked about that in previous episodes. And I looked at this, I'm like, okay, well, this could be an interesting, like, if this is an organization that exists in the plains, it would make sense for them to make an appearance then in this campaign where my players are running into or dealing with cards from the Deck of Many Things. But I'm like, I just don't know how it fits. and how I would use it. And then I got to the adventure hook section, and I saw the sleeping village adventure hook that they mentioned. It's like, oh, that's totally a thing that could exist in Prismere. This village who's asleep, and this one member of the Solar Bastion who's there, sort of looking into it, and suddenly that fit.
I mean, Witchlight has its like NPC group of good guys and NPC group of bad guys,
yes,
right? And just plugging them straight into the Solar Bastion and the Grim Harrow, like, done.
Right.
It's an option.
It is an option. And I considered, doing for like the sleeping village thing instead, using the Palace of Heart's Desire that's frozen in time, right? And suddenly there's an unfrozen member of the Solar Bastion who's there, and it would fit that if I made those NPCs that are already there members of the Grim Harrow or Solar Bastion, maybe that member of the Solar Bastion is there trying to figure out how to free the others, and that helps hook the players into freeing those other NPCs from time, because there's not a really strong narrative that guides players to doing that anyway.
But
I would like to point out.
Go ahead.
I would like to point out there's an NPC in this chapter who's named Jared, who wants to help but needs encouragement to get over being unsure of himself and feeling isolated. And I feel called out by this NPC.
Yeah. feeling extremely seen. but I love the Solar Bastion quests. I really appreciate how readily you could just belong to this order, possibly without even the rest of the PCs knowing about it necessarily.
Well, and it's worth noting that list of Solar Bastion quests is under the Solar Bastion patronage. They're leaning into this patronage idea from Tasha's Cauldron of Everything. That honestly, and I feel like they haven't done enough of adding new patrons and that kind of stuff. And so I like seeing that they're playing with that idea here.
I mean, it's definitely the case that they can't assume you have a copy of Tasha's.
No, but I don't think you need a copy of Tasha's to be able to look at this and be like, hey, I can use this.
Right, I agree with that.
And it's still helpful.
Yeah. I like how they call out, like, here are the perks. Here are, you know, the people you have access to if you need to talk to somebody about something. I like how it calls out, it's not just this is someone giving you jobs. This is also, this is why you would be part of this and how you would run the campaign.
Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of middle management here.
I did like, that's also a nice subtle thing that didn't hit me until later. The reason this is a Spelljammer location and not a planar location, even though it is run by a celestial, is that he quit his job. Like, he was working for a god and quit his job. So it kind of makes sense that this isn't a planar location. It's just somewhere in a prime material where it's like, nope, setting up shop here.
And I like so they established that the Solar Bastion is that they run all over the place. They're doing all kinds of things, so they can show up literally anywhere. They have vast resources. So if your players need access to a thing, the Solar Bastion can provide that. But also, they are one organization of like 100-ish people. So they have vast resources, but they have to kind of pick and choose when they're going to use it, which is why, and this is why if I want to make the Solar Bastion canon in my game, but not have them showing up and interfering all the time, that's why, because they're always like, they have vast resources, but they're always stretched thin because there's only 100 of them to go to span the infinite planes.
Maybe they should hire some PCs. That's just thought I had.
Recruitment drive.
But no, that it's really very cool stuff.
So any other thoughts on the Solar Bastion? All right. We are in our, within our 15 minute window. We bought ourselves a 5 extra minutes to talk about the moon. Nope. To talk about moon.
Moon.
That's a really good Sam Rockwell movie. I really like that movie.
Yeah, I don't know.
I went to it not really knowing what I was getting, but man, it's really good.
Okay.
It's Sam Rockwell.
It's Sam Rockwell. It's just about only Sam Rockwell.
Yeah,
other than also a little bit of voice acting from Kevin Spacey. Hey, we didn't know at the time, dude.
I know.
So, chapter 11, Moon. Oh, go ahead.
We go from an organization with one leader to an organization with three, and they're all werepeople.
Although one of them's dead.
This one was kind of weird to me.
Uh-huh.
I guess. And this one is not set up. This is not set up like a multiplanar organization either. This is a pick a prime material, and that's where this organization is from.
Right, and they have like portals, but to other cities on that world.
Yeah.
So they're a multi-city, multi-regional thieves guild, basically, of lycanthropes. But they're not multi-planar. But here's the hook. They're connected to the deck of many things because one of the leaders desperately wants access to the wish spell. And the night hag that works with them performs some sort of ritual that anytime anybody on that world pulls the moon card that grants a wish, she gets notified of it. Then she can go, or the leader who hired her can go and confront that person and try to bargain for their wish, because it turns out that leader wants to use the wish to end his lycanthropy, which of course could create a rift within the organization, because the whole concept of the organization is that it's a thieves guild made up of lycanthropes.
What's interesting to me about this is I don't dislike this when I say it's weird. I'm just saying, like, last chapter, we have an organization that your PCs might work with. Mm-hmm. Next chapter, just as a preview, is an organization you might work against. This is more of a campaign framework using an organization.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I was slightly bored. I don't know if bored is the right word, but not enthused with this and the previous chapter, because it felt somewhat obvious. Like, there are good parts of it that are less obvious, but like the idea that Sun is just this beneficial, like benevolent, only good organization and doesn't do any, and then now you have thieves for the moon, is just meh.
Well, Solar Bastion are cops. If your plans for the deck of many things aren't what they would think they should be.
But they don't forcibly take anything from you or try to stop you or make you do anything.
They say, as a general rule, they don't, but they also say they're willing to ignore that rule if necessary.
Right. Subcontract.
I see prevent the deck's misuse, and I think that could be read multiple ways.
Yeah, it just felt like they'd spent some amount of ink to make it sound like that was incredibly rare.
Yeah.
They did. And it's not like the white cloaks from Wheel of Time or something.
You know, the harmonium from Planescape.
Yeah.
So the thing that I noticed from the chapter Moon is maybe really super specific, but I'm working on a thing about lycanthropes right now, and their whole approach to studying lycanthropes changes in this chapter from what's in the monster manual. They've shifted away from immunity to weapons that aren't silver or magic, and onto they have regeneration that is only shut down by silver. Did you hear me say or magic? I did not say or magic.
Yeah, that is interesting. And isn't that the same that they did with the werewolf in
I do think Ravenloft? They've used this before. It's just, I honestly didn't read Ravenloft the very most closely. So it's the first time I really noticed that shift.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't tell you is that chill touch is the other way to kill a werewolf.
We are at the point in the life of 5th edition, and new core books coming out soon, that we can expect that the books that we're seeing now are giving us some hints about the way things will probably be going forward.
Sort of, except that the design of even things like legendary actions still seems like it's kind of up in the air.
Sure.
Because this is coming out at the same time as something else. And are we doing legendary actions or are we doing super reactions?
I wonder if this will be more indicative of things that might be coming up because this is designed by a bunch of different people, or if Eve of Ruin is going to be a lot more indicative of stuff that we're going to see in the 2024 rules, because that is being done by more people that are part of the core team.
That's fair. I don't know. I just would not be surprised to see that this is the way werewolves are, or were creatures are going to work moving forward. And it wouldn't be a huge change, but it would kind of change the flavoring of the way these creatures work to a point that I don't know that I dislike it. It's definitely different than what D&D has done recently, but it's more evocative.
I've seen werewolf movies that go with that trope where it's like, yeah, they get, you know, you can rip them to shreds. They're just going to keep healing unless you use silver on them.
It feels like the werewolf tropes that you see outside of D&D.
Especially in, you know, that other company, that White Wolf company.
Right. Yep.
The other thing that I did like about this is they bring up that this is a good guild to use as potential rivals if you're running keys from the Golden Vault. And I really did like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They generalized it to be like, if your players are stealing something, they could be rivals, you know, for example, if they were playing one of the adventures in Keys from the Golden Vault. You could take all of the non-setting specific organizations and locations from this book and Bigby and Fizbin's and the vault of the golden keys, whatever. I just lost the title. You could end up creating the fifth edition version of like the Nintyr Vale setting, right? With all of these things going on in a single, like they're doing world building without putting them in a world, but you could kind of just put all of them in a world and sort of see what new setting you end up creating.
By the way, the other organization besides the Golden Vault that was introduced in the Golden Vault book was the Syndicate of Terror, Extortion, Assassination, and Larceny, also known as Steel.
Very nice.
Uh-huh.
And there's one weird thing.
Go ahead.
There was a weird thing though in this when it gets into the campaign use side of things where it kind of implies maybe you could join this guild yourself. Or they basically talk about how if you do this opening job to prove yourselves, then they make you into lycanthropes. And I'm like, are they advocating having player characters that have lycanthropy there? Because this is not enough information to shift that paradigm in fifth edition for that.
Right.
Yeah, you should not have PC lycanthropes. I genuinely do not care what the Critical Role book says. Don't do it.
See, I don't hate PC lycanthropes other than the fifth edition rules don't support it very well.
I am talking about the fifth edition rules and specifically the immunity to non-magic damage.
Yeah.
Well, there's that, and then like it says in this chapter in particular that the guild members all lock themselves up in the hall on the full moons because it's too disruptive and they'd get revealed. So then you'll have to take into account as you're playing your game, right?
Yeah, it's just a really weird kind of one-off that's like, I don't know that I would even introduce that as a possibility.
Yeah.
Even as a little one-off thing here.
Right.
It's gonna be a pass for me.
You could maybe function better as freelancers for the guild than joining them and becoming lycanthropes.
Yeah.
Yep. And I could see. You mentioned Keys from the Golden Vault, and they're actually cited a couple times in this section, in this chapter. And I could see this being a pretty strong foil to the organization from Keys in the Golden Vault. And PC sort of jumping from one to the other or vice versa in interesting ways. So.
And I do like the built-in tension there, if you can make it a plot point, because it doesn't exist unless the table finds out about it.
Right.
But I like that idea that you have two guild masters that could potentially be at odds, mm-hmm. because one is going to feel betrayed if the other one gets what they want.
Oh, yeah.
That is a neat behind the scenes thing where it's not just here's an evil guild, raid them and kill all of them.
Right. Because it was founded by three guild masters. One of them died. And then of the other two, one of them is desperately looking for a wish. And that's what the Night Hag is helping with. So that he can, and it turns out if you get that wish, cause you drew the moon card, from the deck, then this Night Hag is going to come knocking on your door and saying, hey, did you use that wish yet? Cause I got someone who wants to buy it off of you. And you know, wishes are risky. They'll take all of the risk if you give them the wish, and they'll give you something of high value. But of course, what happens if they succeed and the guild finds out and sees it as a betrayal? But this is a group of lycanthropes and you just cured yourself. You know, what happens if it doesn't happen? But the other guild leader finds out that that's what they were trying to do. Like now there's that. Yeah. Now there's that really interesting tension within the guild of one of the leaders is trying to not be a lycanthrope anymore. And that is seen by the other one as a betrayal of who they are and what they're all about.
And he needs a wish spell because he is a natural lycanthrope. He was not turned later in life.
Yeah, it felt a little weird.
Yeah,
that's fair.
Tell us about why it feels weird.
Because it's like very rare that you have a natural born lycanthrope, right? Mm-hmm. It says it, I think, in that chapter, and that's the one that wants to be changed. That's the character that wants to be changed back to not have that anymore. And it's about identity and all of this other stuff with the guild. So it just felt a little weird to me. I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah, no, I can see that. But, you know, you could see it as he's trying to define his identity in a way that he's comfortable with. And lycanthropy is not part of that. For better or worse.
Yeah, it gets close to playing with some ideas like we often do in fantasy and science fiction, right? About identity or other social constructs and stuff like that without it necessarily feeling fully developed. So it felt dangerous to me reading it. Like not dangerous, bad dangerous, but like that it could play out in weird ways at a table.
If your table's not careful or explicit about how to handle that.
Sure. Yeah, well, and also like the character art itself, it's Augustus is the one that wants to change, right? And he's presented as a darker skinned character, so there's that part of it. And then there's the height differences, which is fine too, between the two guild masters that remain. Definitely in favor of people living their how they want to feel, like type of thing, right?
Sure.
He doesn't really want to be that. That's cool and everything. It's just it's not set up well. I mean, you could easily see this as related to like somebody coming out as trans or something like that, and like the people feel that's a betrayal, right? And stuff.
Sure.
So it's complicated.
Identity oftentimes is.
Yeah.
Yep.
On, I think that's kind of like what I was saying before too. It's how much of this can you get to the table so that you have context for it without just doing an exposition dump to your players?
Right.
Yep. All right. Any other thoughts on chapter 11? Ooh, we did it with like minutes to spare. All right, then I'm going to go ahead and call that the end of the episode. I want to thank our panelists tonight. Brandis, if people want to find you on the internet, where do they go?
You can find me on Blue Sky. I am brandisstoddard.bsky.social. You can find me at tribality.com. My personal blog is brandisstoddard.com, and my Patreon is brandisstoddard.
And Jared, what about you?
Okay, so if you want to read some of the reviews that I do, you can go to gnomestew.com. If you want to read the rest of the reviews that I do, you can go to whatdoiknowjr.com, which is my personal blog. And if you want to hear me talking more about D&D with my friend Ange, you can listen to Thacko with Advantage.
Excellent. I also want to say thank you to everyone who supports us by being patrons over at patreon.com/thetomeshow. It helps me pay the bills and very shortly will help me upgrade Brandis's microphone.
I suppose we'll see.
And then if you'd like to contact us, you can send an email to thetomeshow@gmail.com. You can find me and Jeff on social media at various places. I'm Sarah Dark Magic, that's Sarah with an H on most of social media, including Blue Sky, Instagram, and a few others. And you can find Jeff as Squatch, S-Q-U-A-C-H, on a whole bunch of places.
Wherever I'm at. And if you don't see me being active, then message me and or send me a mention or whatever, and then I'll pop in to see who's talking about me. Anyway, that is episode 367, where we drew our fourth card from the deck of many things. You know, we draw too many, it's going to start getting dangerous. We're going to run into some of the bad cards. In this episode of The Tome.
I'm on the wall.